You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
Hey, welcome everybody to the fantastic voyage, the Here District. This is the captain of this vessel, Captain Marcus Johnson. I don't know why I sound like Robert Shaw from Jaws.
Is that Scotty? That's supposed to be Scotty?
You know, I'm morphing all kind of just. Well, we got to get J.J. Does a nice, who did I hear him do during the Hall of Fame speech? Dikembe, I believe it was, the late, great Dikembe Mutombo. But anyway, I digress. First of all, this is the Here District. This is the fantastic voyage. I'm the captain of this vessel, my first mate, Chris Johnson. Chris Johnson, Marcus Johnson, the only father and son tandem in the history of the NCAA, J.A., to win a national championship at the same school, UCLA, 20 years apart, 1995-1975. And we are so honored. Man, this is big time. You know, this is, when you got a recent recipient of the Kurt Gowdy Hall of Fame Award for print media, that gives you an idea just kind of a heavyweight this young man is. J.A. Adande. J.A. Adande, welcome to the show, man. We appreciate you so much joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here with a couple Bruin greats. I'm not a UCLA guy, but my mom went there, so I was born at UCLA Medical Center, so I was a Bruin by birth.
And here's the thing. We worked together. Didn't we co-host a radio show or something? Was it Fox Sports?
We did, briefly, yeah. Wasn't quite Fox Sports, yeah. It was kind of an independent outfit.
It was a radio, yeah. We co-hosted some kind of radio
deal. Celebrity Sports Talk.
Yeah. I was thinking about that this morning. But it's funny, man, how you could know someone, know of their work, and I always pegged you as a Midwest guy. I don't know why. Don't ask me. I knew you worked a lot extensively in Chicago, Northwestern, all that. Then I come to find out, Chris, brother went to Crossroads.
Right. I knew that.
Did you? Yeah. I didn't know that. And I say that, Jay, because a point of reference, Chris played at a small private school out in the valley, Van Nuys, Montclair Prep, his first 2 years of high school. And Crossroads
They went to Delphic League.
Delphic League. Austin Crozier was there. The Lucius Allen sons, Bakir and Khalil. I mean, we had some battles. Was Daryl Roper around when you were at
Crossroads? Daryl was around there when I was there, you know. of course, you know, Cash Warren, right? Cash Warren, his dad played at UCLA, right?
Yeah, Mike, of course. Yeah. Well, did he play at UCLA? He was a point guard for Kareem on those early championship teams when Kareem was there, 67 through about 1969, I believe. But yeah, man, so I bring that up just to say that. So I'm listening, man. First of all, congratulations, well-deserved on the Hall of Fame. What an honor. You know, Chris, I don't know what I got to do. I got to write a Pulitzer Prize-winning piece on sports journalism or something to get a sniff. I don't know what I got to do, man. But congratulations to you. And so I'm listening to your Hall of Fame acceptance speech, which is just outstanding. And you mentioned a lady at Crossroads that I think your ninth grade English teacher. And can you just give us a brief kind of the brief version of that story that got you started in sports journalism?
Exactly. Her name was Ann Colbert, my ninth grade English teacher, who was also the advisor for the student newspaper at Crossroads. And so she took one of my essays for class about basketball and she said, I want to run this in the school papers. So she did that. That was my first published story. And at the end of the year, she invited me or drafted me. I always say to, it was the only time I was really drafted, but she drafted me onto the school paper. And that was the start of my writing career. And I would say that was the push I needed. It was something I wanted to do, but I don't know if I had the initiative to do it. And so Crossroads, being at a school like that with teachers like Ann, really got me going. And it's funny, there's another MBA connection. She sent me a real nice email after my speech. And she said, I taught her to appreciate sports. She wasn't much of a sports fan. And so So through reading my stuff and through my passion for sports and through, you know, my understanding that sports could be kind of a gateway to larger societal and cultural discussions, she came to appreciate it. So 10 years after I was there, that's when Baron Davis came to Crossroads and she said, because of me, she could appreciate what a big deal it was that Baron Davis was coming to Crossroads. Before, she wouldn't have cared. Oh, he's just some basketball player. But, you know, all the hoopla that accompanied Baron, she realized, like, okay, this now she was prepared to accept that. So I thought it was cool that I taught her a little something because she taught me so much and, you know, really helped launch my career.
And you mentioned Baron Davis, one of the all-time greats out of Los Angeles. I think he actually lived in the Crenshaw District, but somehow wound up at Crossroads. I don't know
Fremont.
How that happened.
Fremont
District. He was a city guy.
Private school, you know.
Yeah, private. Now, what was the tuition like when you were there? Was it over $10,000 a year at that point?
No, it was still under. It was probably like $4,500, $5,000 when I started, and like $7,500 when I graduated. Like now I know it's the good old days, right?
It is exponentially more, like probably 10 times that these days. But Baron, I remember going up to Crossroads for something. I think Josiah was going to Crossroads. My son Josiah, second son as a middle school student. And I saw Baron was working on a scene. He had on a wig and a dress there. What did you know say about these brothers in dresses in Hollywood? But I guess he was getting prepared. He had on a wig and a dress, and he was working on a scene with Kate Hudson at a lunch table. Yeah. And and I walked up to him, and, you know, I had known him from the Inglewood YMCA, where he and Chris had played different levels because of age. But that Crossroad experience, for people that have no idea, I mean, the emphasis on the arts, man, it's just on a whole nother level, right?
Yeah, the full name is the Crossroads School for Arts and Sciences. And it's funny, because if you'd played basketball, you know, in the 10 years after I was there, yeah, you could have played with future NBA player Austin Crozier. You could have played with future NBA player Baron Davis. But if you were in the acting era from my era on, then, yeah, you could have been with Kate Hudson. You could have been acting with Jack Black. You could have been acting with Maya Rudolph. So we obviously retired Austin and Baron's numbers. But, man, if you retired all the acting and Hollywood greats that came out of Crossroads, there wouldn't be enough room up in the rafters.
Well, Chris's school, Montclair Prep. Let's go down the list, Chris. The Kardashians, Michael Jackson was there for a minute. Cher was there.
Wow.
Who's the guy that played football in Eddie Cyprian was
Eddie
the
Cyprian.
Star of
Cyprian,
yeah.
Yeah, Coach Tim. And you know who else was a JV wannabe superstar?
Robin Thicke.
Robin Thicke, man.
That was my guy. Hey, Robin was my guy, J.A. That was my guy. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's what
Shout
I was,
out to
I was,
Montclair
I was,
Prep. I didn't realize you guys had all those
yeah,
celebrities.
Yeah, I was coaching. I helped my friend Bob Webb coach the varsity there. And Robin Thicke was a JV coach, and he was always up in me like, you know, I can take you one-on-one, man, blah, blah. But he was a real cool dude, man, and a lot of good memories. But let's get back to the Hall of Fame speech. One thing I got to ask you about. When did Pat Riley tell you to kiss his ass?
So I wrote a column. It was what turned out, I think, his last year at the Miami Heat. They got off to a bad start. Actually, no, it wasn't his last year because he came back again and coached Shaq and them to the championship. But so this is around whenever MJ came back, 2001, 2002. And they were getting off to a bad start. So I wrote, you know, it's not MJ that's embarrassed himself coming back. It's Pat Riley. He needs to step down, and because you know they were like 3-13 or something like that. You know they're off to this horrendous start, and so I wrote it. They're in town playing the Clippers, and obviously he's not pleased with it. And then so he reads the column to his team. Like you can hear him shouting, you know, before the game in the locker room, this is what they think about you. They think I should quit. You know, we're not a bunch of quitters. What do you think? So they go out and they're a terrible team. And then they almost beat the Clippers. They were so fired up. And so now the Clippers are mad at me. Why'd you write that? You know, you got them fired up. You almost cost us the game. So now I got both sides mad. So, you know, the great Tony Kornheiser taught me, you know, if you go after somebody in the paper or online these days, you got to show up the next day, you know, and let them go back at you if they so choose. And so had to wait around after the game, and I walk out with Pat, and that was the first time I'd really met him as an adult. You know, I'd seen him around as a kid growing up here in L.A. during the 80s, but here I was, you know, professional, first time really talking to him one-on-one, not in a group of reporters. I said, Pat, I'm J.A. Adande. You know, I'm the one that wrote that column in the Times today. He says, J.A., kiss my ass. And then he says, no, you know what? I'm just repeating what somebody told me. So he told me he was walking around the hotel in Beverly Hills that morning. And he says, some guy on the street said, hey, Riles, you know, tell that J.A. Adande to kiss your ass. You know, so he said he was just passing along for somebody else. And then, then funny because he says, I'm not going to quit. We're not going to quit. You know me, we don't quit. I'm not going to quit. 2 weeks later, of course, yeah, you quit, stepped down. Yeah. So I was vindicated. And, you know, ultimately, we shared a laugh. I reminded him of a little reception before the Hall of Fame ceremony. So we shared a laugh over it.
Before I let you get here, Chris, I know you got a lot to ask Jay. But so Pat Riley, man, you know, when I think about Pat Riley in terms of my career development, my confidence, he plays a major role, Jay. When he was with the Lakers at the UCLA men's gym, we went at each other every single day. He had the long hair and the headband and the beard and the whole Pat Riley thing back in those days.
70s Riley.
He's always GQ Riley. And I was out there waxing his, talking about kicking somebody's behind, but we were going at it. But he would always tell me just how great I was going to be on the next level. He's like, yeah, you know, college is limiting this, that, and the other, but you're going to be, you know. And so I've always had this special affinity for him because he gave me so much confidence.
So he was your Ann Coburn.
He was one of my many Ann Coburns that just, you know, and that's important, right? I mean, do you have that opportunity? I'm sure you do, but as a professor. Adjunct professor at the, where were you at, the Annenberg?
Well, I was adjunct at USC, and now I'm full-time at Northwestern.
Yeah, Annenberg's at USC, but so you're full-time at Northwestern.
At Medill.
But what's that like for you in terms of passing on the knowledge, encouraging promising students to discouraging? Do you ever have to tell
you might
somebody?
Want to find another line of work.
Do you ever have to? How do you go in that direction if you really found the need to tell someone they had no writing talent whatsoever? Do you even go there, or do you try and encourage?
Well, you know what's cool is that now there's so many forms, right? It used to be either writing or television, and now there's other ways. And of course, there's ways to make an impact, you know, behind the camera or as an editor too, or something like that, where you're not front facing, public facing. You know, I had someone who the writing wasn't that great, but he was a good storyteller. He just kind of had an affable personality. Now he really should host a podcast. You know, that was my message to him. Think about hosting a podcast. So. If it's not there in one direction, then there's another way you can go. But it's funny. I think about how my hope is to, you know, maybe one day at somebody's Hall of Fame speech, 20, 30 years from now, they're talking about me the way that I could talk about Ann Coburn, you know, and it's funny. I never knew that Riley. So would you have thought back then, Marcus, that he would be a coach just from the messages he was giving you?
With the look and come down to the beach and let's drink some beer. Let's do some. Come on, man. Come on, hang with me. You know, not at all. Not in my wildest imagination. And then, as history would have it, he cleaned himself up and slicked his hair back and put on some Armani suits, and the rest is history. But in retrospect,
you can see the genesis of it then.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
J.A., you know, being a professor, teaching the next generation of aspiring journalists, it must be sort of a dance between how you were taught, kind of the old school ways, and then incorporating some of the new school kind of ways into your curriculum. Just kind of go over your approach in educating today's, you know, aspiring sports journalists on how to make it in this industry.
Well, one thing I still adhere to here at Medill is called the Medill F. And that's if you have a factual error in your story, then that's a failing grade for that assignment, because it's critical that you get the facts straight first and foremost, right? We can't be making mistakes. So if you don't capitalize the B in LeBron, that's the F for the
that's
whole
F?
Assignment.
Damn. Yeah, damn, you tough, bro.
How does LeBron spell his name?
I get it.
With
I
a capital
it.
B, right?
I get it.
So if I can't trust you to spell LeBron's name right, how can I trust you to report on anything else, right? Like the facts matter and accuracy matters. So we start with that. So that's an old school thing that was instilled in me, and not just me, obviously generations of students at Medill that I still carry forward to this day. And my students appreciate it. It's funny. Zach Kleiman, the general manager of the Memphis Grizzlies, was one of my students at USC. And he always recalls that story of how he got Dwayne Wade spelled wrong. You know, it's
D-W-Y.
That's tricky. That's a tricky,
it's a tricky one. Hey, that one's gotten a lot of my students this day. It's funny.
Wait, D-W-Y-A-Y-N-E?
This one Y, but the Y is out of place compared to
the Y is all great.
Spelled, right?
It's like, why is the Y there?
A-N-E.
Right. Yeah.
It's funny. Like there was a player at Miami, the Hurricanes, in the 90s, Michael Barrow, and he spelled it M-I-C-H-E-A-L.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My first job, my internship was after college was at the Miami Herald. So I was writing Michael Barrow's name a lot, and it got in my head so much that when I'd see the name Michael spelled the customary spelling, it would throw me off. But Dwayne Wade has undone many an assignment over the years, but Zach still talks about it because it stuck with him. And I had other students. I had a student who went on to work at the Tournament of Roses in Pasadena, worked on the Rose Parade, and she was sending out press releases, right? And she would double and triple check the spelling of the names, because you don't want something come out at nice Tournament of Roses letterhead with all the fancy flowers and everything and have somebody's name spelled wrong. So that's something that continues. Something that's changed is, obviously I don't expect them to work for a decade plus in newspapers like I did. So we're changing that. I'm starting to ease up on, it's called Associated Press style, which is kind of a style guidelines, you know, that were adopted widespread. To have some consistency in just the terminology and, you know, you spell out numbers 1 through 9 and it's the numerals 10 and above, things like that. Right. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I think is going to end up going away, because you have fewer news outlets that subscribe to the Associated Press or follow AP style. Mm-hmm. Right. So is it as important to keep teaching that if the students aren't going to use that as they graduate and go into the career? So that's something where I see changing, you know, the advent of social media. And now I think we're starting to see the decline of social media. So it's funny. It used to be like I would teach it kind of toward the end of my, you know, it didn't exist at all when I first started teaching in 04. And then I'd start kind of mentioning it. And then it kind of moved up further and further into toward the start of my quarter or semester as I started teaching. And now it's moving back down as we've seen the downfall of Twitter. So that's something that's kind of almost come and gone in the 20 years that I've been teaching.
With Woj retiring and getting out kind of the breaking news game and the sourcing game, do you think that traditional sports media, the way we get the news, breaking news, is going to shift, is going to change, or is it going to stay kind of in a similar wheelhouse as how it's been?
Well, I think it'll stay in this mode that Twitter got it to, where it became such a race to get it out first, that the standards lowered. And it's not that Woj lowered the standards, because the bottom line, Woj, he always got it right. Right. So Woj had a high level of accuracy, but I think a lot of people that were trying to out Woj sometimes didn't maintain the traditional background that he came up through. And so that race to be first lowered the standards, where rather than have two or three sources before you went public with a story, now it's just one. And I've done that myself. I've been guilty of, I remember it was kind of like publish first, ask questions later. I remember one time, you know, I heard something from one person and I just went with it. It's interesting, because that same person years before had told me something, and I checked with, you know, it's like, it sounded good, but let's double check. And I got some of my colleagues at ESPN and we couldn't corroborate it, so we didn't go with it. And it turned out to be true that Shaq was going to get traded, or it was going to sign with the Cavaliers, right? So I'd heard it first. No one else had it, but we couldn't get that confirmation, right? And then years later, that same source told me something, and I just went with it, one source, and hoped that it was right. And in this case, it turned out to be right, you know, but it's just kind of antsy, you know, that you're waiting to have it verified after you're already out there going with it.
Last thing on this, MJ, real quick. I find it fascinating the role of agents and then front office personnel play in today's kind of breaking news game, whereas, you know, they're very selective on who they give the story to. How do you kind of navigate that when you're teaching your students specifically about sourcing Is that something that you guys cover in your curriculum?
It is. It's about, you know, cultivating sources. Well, one thing that I've taught the whole time is that, you know, it's a relationship business. You know, the two things in this business, we're not making any products, right? We're not manufacturing something that you can go buy. What we're selling is trust. You know, you have to trust us. You know, that's all we have to offer is our credibility, wow. right? That's why it's so important Facts. That you get everything right. And that you verify things and that you spell all the names right. Because the only thing we have to offer is if somebody needs to be able to trust that if they see me on TV saying something, if they read an article by me, that is true. And that I've done as best as I can to verify this information. Trust and relationships, right? And cultivating those relationships so people will entrust you mm-hmm. with the information. You know, building sources and understanding that you just have to work your way up. You know, someone that you just meet is not going to turn around. Oh yeah. I heard, you know, player X is going to sign with this team. Right. So, it's building up that relationship, proving to them that you can trust them, that they can tell you something off the record that you're not going to run and report. Right. So you build the relationship that way. And so then to the point where, hey, I need this on the record, you know, or I need to be able to publish this. They, you know, that they'll think this is the person I need to go to with this information first, because I know they're going to get it right. And, you know, another thing about that agent and general manager world, it keeps the necessity for, you know, independent media alive in this era when everyone has their own podcasts and players, coaches, you know, and then there's behind the scenes documentaries and Hard Knocks and all that stuff. You still need outside media to generate trade rumors, right? If a team kind of wants to let it be known that a player is available, you know, you put something out there through the media. If a player wants out and is hoping to get traded, or, you know, is trying to, you know, kind of pave the way for a free agency departure, you have to do that through the media anonymously, right? Because it's in the collective bargaining agreement that you're not allowed to talk about these things.
So listen, man, when I was with Fox Sports, we had a great producer, executive producer, Mark Mayer. And he used to push me and drive me and criticize my work. But he was a guy, Jay, that told me that the future of sports journalism, this was back in the early 2000s, right? Okay, because I was covering the Knicks and Spurs, 99, the lockout year. So right around then. But he tried to get me, Jay, to segue into being an insider. It's like, you know, use your contacts, you know, come up with rumors, come up with speculation, come up with this and come up with that. And it just wasn't in my personality. Now, a friend of mine that started out with us at Fox Sports after a quick stint at, I think, Sports Illustrated's cable news, Stephen A. Smith, he jumped right into that niche, man, and filled it admirably. And he took it and ran with it. For you, was there ever any coercion, any pressure, any suggestion that maybe you should try and look to become this hard-hitting insider that, you know, scooped everybody and came up with some dirt on people or whatever. I mean, was there any, because your personality doesn't seem to go that direction, much like mine. But I'm just curious, was that ever something that was on the table for you?
Yeah, and, you know, it had been talked about at ESPN. And you know, if I'd gone that path, you know, who knows, maybe I'd be looking at one of those $20 million a year deals like Stephen A has, you know. So like Stephen A worked really hard and you know, put himself, and he's just great at what he does. So he put himself in position for that. So you're right. It's the problem with it is that you can never rest. And much like sports, you know, Marcus, you had a great lengthy NBA career. Like the wins don't feel as good as the losses feel bad, right? You know, right. And the disappointments feel like you hear Doc Rivers. I'm sure he's talked about it with you. Like, as good as that 08 championship feels, like when him and that Celtics group get together, they talk about that loss in 2010 and that game 7 loss to the Lakers. That kind of sits with them even more than winning in 2008, right? And so you're not going to get every scoop when you're trying to be the insider, and the losses hurt more than the wins feel good. Wow. Right. So that's one aspect of it. Another, Woj just talked about that. There's a great story he did with Chris Mannix of Sports Illustrated about, you know, just the suffering they had. Woj spoke to my class a few years ago, And he talked about the one time that he went out and it's like, all right, I'm not going to turn my phone on. I'm leaving my phone off, you know? And, when he turned it back on after going to dinner with his family, all the James Harden trade to the Rockets happened and he missed it, you know, and he got beat on it. And he was like, okay, I can never do this again. So I just didn't want to live that life. You know, it worked out really well for Woj. He made millions of dollars. But you saw, like, he stepped away from it this year because it's really hard to continue to live that life, you know. But I wouldn't discourage people from doing it, in part because in this era, one way to make yourself AI, artificial intelligence, not Allen Iverson, the artificial intelligence proof, is AI can't break news, right? It can't break news and it can't report and it can't, it's not really allowed to have opinions. So being very opinionated or being a newsbreaker, those are two ways to insulate yourself against artificial intelligence coming for your job.
Yeah, and so now here's a story. So during that period of time, working with Stephen A. Smith at Fox Sports, and you could see he was on that pathway to superstardom. They used to never tell me he was going to be like my co-host or co-whatever analyst after a game, but they'd always spring him on me at the last moment. You know, so I think I'm going to come up. I've watched the game. I've got my facts down. Okay, we're going to have Stephen A. join you. And he would always shoot down whatever I had to say. He would just knock it down point by point. You know, you sound like a coach. But there's one time there was a rumor that he came up with that involved Kiki Vandeweghe of the Denver Nuggets. Kiki was the general manager of the Nuggets. So, you know, Kiki and I, you know, I've been knowing Kiki since he's 14. Guy. Yeah, I groomed him. He came up to UCLA when he was in high school. We worked out together every summer. That's my guy. I call up Kiki. Is this true or not? He's like, Marcus, Stephen A. is making that up out of whole cloth. I'm like, great. I finally got him. We go on the air that evening, and Stephen A. presents this scenario, you know, as fact, and this is what's going to happen. Denver's involved. So I get to say, well, look, Stephen A., I spoke to Kiki Vandeweghe, and he told me you was making up this story out of whole cloth. Now, you would expect in that situation a guy to kind of back down and say, okay, well, Marcus, you got me. But this is what kind of turned me off, and which is I respect Stephen A. so much for this because he just, like, stayed with it. And he's like, I don't care who you talk to. I don't care who you talk to. You know, and he went off on that tangent.
Who wound up being right?
Yeah, well, I was right in the long run, but it didn't matter. Because he had obfuscated the issue so perfectly just by his emotion and just how vociferously he was protecting his position, you know what I mean? And so it was just, but and so I just didn't have, I knew right then that I didn't have the heart, whatever you want to call it, that just wasn't me. It wasn't my personality to fight and battle.
You had the instincts though, Marcus, because let me call the source. You know, let me call it a reputable source.
But it didn't mean But it didn't mean anything. See, but it meant nothing.
It did, though. You were right. All that matters in something. The end is were you right. and I would like to think that. I would argue, in this day and age, publicly, it kind of doesn't matter in the public.
Right.
Perception as much anymore. You know, like the public standards have dropped to the point that it almost doesn't matter. It just matters. Did you say something that will make for a good viral clip?
Yeah.
Regardless of whether or not it turns out to be true. Right. Yeah. That's something that disturbs me about the state of facts. The industry these days.
Yeah. Well, in our age of alternative facts, you know what I mean? Like there's a whole nother.
Once
set
that
of...
phrase entered the lexicon, I was like, it was over.
It was over.
It was like Kellyanne Conway. I'll never forget that moment listening to her talk. And she said, well, we've got some alternative facts that, you know, and that was like, wow. Okay. So let's move on, man. Kobe Bryant. Your Hall of Fame speech, you talked about, you know, how much, you know, you wanted to appreciate Vanessa and the kids for allowing you to kind of dominate his time. But just talk about your relationship with him. And Chris and I were talking about Kobe the other day, and Chris was talking about his footwork. And yeah, this guy, it's you know, I've kind of hated on Kobe a little bit, the great, God rest his soul. But when they talk about the greatest Lakers of all times, I grew up in the Jerry West, Elgin Baylor, Magic Johnson era. So it's hard for me to put him up there as the top Laker of all, the Kareem, Wilt, all that. But, man, when you just see the Chris posted what the points he scored one season, that great season that he had, averaging about 36 a game. But just talk about, man, Kobe, and explain to people just because now he's taking on a whole new life in terms of after death, a whole new life in terms of just not only that Mamba mentality, but just his insights, the intelligence, the intellect, the basketball intellect that he possesses is on a whole nother plane that I don't think he gets enough credit for.
Well, and Marcus, not just the intellect, but the historical perspective. And then he was able to provide, he became someone that was reliable because in the later stages of his career, he was someone who had actually played against Michael Jordan, right? So he could describe that. You know, a lot of the great young players that came up after him couldn't describe what it was like to compete against Michael Jordan. And so he had that firsthand experience. And he had, you know, grown up watching those 80s Lakers. And I tell the story a lot, but it's funny. It kind of speaks to his perspective. He, you know, when he was moving up through the top 10 of the all-time scoring leaders, like he'd pass Oscar Robertson or he'd pass this guy or that guy, Elgin Baylor, and he kind of described their games, right? And these guys played long before he was even born. So one time I said, Kobe, how did you know what their games are like? You weren't around for them. And he said when he was a kid living in Italy, his grandfather sent him a tape called Golden Greats of Basketball, a video cassette. They had Elgin and Cousy and, you know, you name it, Wilt, Russell, et cetera. And so he watched all that. So he learned how they played and studied them. And, you know, it was hard to incorporate that into his game. The game was so different. It was amazing. So I actually got a copy of the tape on eBay and watched it. I want to see what was Kobe talking about here? And one thing that fascinated me was how, you know, even Elgin, who was reportedly modernized the game, his game looked nothing to me like the game that I grew up watching. But Dr. J did. And you see Dr. J comes along and that's your contemporary and I guess a little bit ahead of you, Marcus. So I don't know how much Dr. J influenced you.
A lot. Well, see, when I was at Crenshaw, 1972, he was with the Virginia Squires. And this guy, Terry O'Neill, my teammate, who grew up in Massachusetts and had saw him play in college. It's like, man, you got to check out this guy named Julius Irvin, Virginia, the ABA game of the week, 10 o'clock in L.A. I guess they started 1 p.m. Eastern time. So and the Squires were always featured. And that's when I first saw him. And, man, right then, Afro, the walk, you know, trying to be all cool and everything, trying to emulate everything that Doc did. But, yes, yeah, I mean, he is my guy. Yes, indeed.
So, you know, but Kobe could talk about all those things, which is cool. I came to appreciate him and value him more in the latter stage of his career when he was, you know, no longer in the running for best players in the league. Like, you know, LeBron and Durant and those guys had taken over the league at that point. But Kobe could give you that perspective and was willing to share it and kind of recognize that that was his role now. I would say in 2008 on that Olympic team in Beijing, he was still the best player on that team. He was the go-to guy in the gold medal game. By 2012, he realized, well, okay, I'm not necessarily the top dog anymore. What I am going to be is the griot. And I'm going to be the storyteller. I'm going to be the bard of this team. And so he was really the go-to speaker for that squad. And his latter years with the Lakers was, I just valued his perspective. And he was just more enjoyable. He kind of eased up a little bit.
Yeah, he did.
He wasn't clashing. He wasn't trying to get to the top of the mountain. When he was on fighting for the top, he elbowing you, you know, not literally elbowing us, but obviously that was kind of his mentality. It was a fight. He was fighting everybody to get to the top.
Yeah. Quick story before you jump in, Chris. So when Chris was at UCLA, Kobe was NBA, but they were working out with this great skills guy, Jalen Rose, named Phil Weber. Phil Weber was assistant coach with the Suns, Knicks. But they work out every day at the men's gym. I'm watching them work out. It was the greatest workout. Phil Weber, I just fell in love with this new age type stuff that he was doing at the time. What year was that, Chris? That'd be your mid-90s, or late 90s or so.
99.
And so Jay, Kobe went out and had a really good year. Really good year. That next summer, he did work out with Phil Weber. And I ran into him somewhere, and I'm like, Kobe, man, you know, I thought Phil Weber really helped your game. How come you didn't work out with him this past summer like you guys did the summer before when you had such a good season? He's like, I don't need Phil Weber. I know what I need to work on. I know what I need to work on. I don't need Phil Weber. I know what I need to work on. I'm like, oh, this dude, this is the end of him, and nobody's gonna hear that. That's the end of Kobe Bryant. Nobody's gonna hear another word. He's gonna, you know, reduce himself to just kind of a bar. He went out that year, I think it averaged like 29 or something crazy, and just jumper. He told me he made 2,500 jump shots, you know, every single day. You know, and we all know, having played, Chris, Jay, you know, on your level, but it's tough to shoot 500 shots, you know, shoot 500 shots, but he made 25. He was just fascinating to me. Just that story always stands out because, you know, I thought that might curtail his development, and he just took it to a whole nother level, knowing himself what he needed to focus on.
Well, almost a rational amount of self-belief, right? And so my thing with Kobe is, I think he suffered from not going to college and not really socializing, you know. And I would say that experience of going to college, where no matter where you came from, you're in that same circumstance, right? You're all going to, you know, you're all in the dorms.
Right.
You all got the public, you know, showers and bathrooms, and that equalizes you, but it helps you interact with people. And I felt like not only did he not have that experience, now he comes into the NBA as a teenager when his teammates are 6, 7, 8 years older than him. So you can't really socialize with them normally. And, you know, as you guys know, the NBA is not really a place for socializing, or at least not educational form of socializing, right? So all those things, I think, hampered him in terms of his development as a teammate, as a leader. So Phil Jackson always tells the story that Kobe said, you know, I want to lead. I'm ready to lead.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil said, okay, but who's going to follow you?
Yeah.
Because he hadn't developed that. He hadn't cultivated that. And I think he got there. But I wonder if it would have happened faster if he could have played for a Coach K, if he could have played for a Dean Smith. Learn from them at that level before coming into the NBA.
I guess my only question is with regards to Kobe. Like, I was always fascinated just throughout his entire career with the degree of difficulty on his shot making ability. Right. I say this today, like, I was just on Synergy the other day going back through, you know, 04 through, like, you know, 2010, just watching some of the stuff he was out there doing. He is the, like, toughest tough shot maker I've ever seen. Would you rank him amongst those, or up? Because he's number one for me. Thank you.
Best bad shot maker of all time.
Easily. And yeah, thank you.
You know who agrees with us, Chris?
Who?
Michael Jordan.
Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson. Because I asked him that one time. I said, is he the best bad shot maker? And he said, yeah, I can see that. And so my thing was always, if I got like 3 to 5 seconds left, I'm giving the ball to Michael Jordan if I can have my pick all the time. If I've got 1 second left and I can't really create a good shot, you get 1 second, you just got to take whatever you can.
Oh, man.
I'm giving it to Kobe. You know, I was there. You find a clip. That clip, remember the last game of the regular season in 2004, they're in Portland, and I think the Pacific Division is on the line. Like, you know, if they win, they got like a top 2 seed. If they lose this game, they're like a 4 or 5 seed or something. He makes a crazy shot to tie it in regulation. Yeah, Ruben Patterson all up in him, you know.
When he fell down after three.
He like wriggles away, you know, and then does the same thing basically in overtime to win it. Right. And there's one of the replays. I was sitting baseline back when they used to sit the media courtside, right? I'm courtside, like at the scorer's table, right? And Kobe makes a shot, and he's on the ground. His follow through is to be on his back. That's how tough the shot was, Chris. His follow through is he's picking himself off the ground, right?
Man.
My mouth is like the emoji, you know, with the big mouth. Like, that was me. I was jaw wide open. Like, it was literally a jaw dropping shot. I'm just staring there in disbelief at what just took place, you know, about 20 feet from it.
Yeah, and let me add this too, because, you know, I was just thinking, you know, it's almost like he's bigger in death than he was in life. But before he passed away, and the reason, you know, he was headed to the Mamba facility, I believe, from Orange County.
Sports Academy.
Helicopter crash with Gigi and the other girls, teammates. Yeah. But he was starting to do so much. He was one of the, in terms of NBA greats and top, you know, profile guys. He was one of the first
led the
to
way.
Really
embrace. He was a trailblazer. He led the way.
The women's game, man. 100%. He was coaching and developing, and he had. I mean, they were practicing five. I talked to the guy that ran the Mamba Academy. He's like, no, we go 5 days a week, 2 or 3 hours a day. That's how serious he was about the development of the girls' game. And his daughter Gigi, of course, that makes it a little easier because you've got a personal investment in there. But talk about him in terms of just that relationship.
Well, it really hit me at the memorial service for him at Staples Center, as it was called then. And as I noticed, the first speakers, and I forget what exact order it was, but it was, you know, Sabrina Ionescu and Diana Taurasi and Gino Auriemma. And as we get into it, I'm realizing, wow, this is a tribute to women's basketball. So they all went first. And then later, you know, it was like Shaq and Michael Jordan, et cetera. First of all, when it started off with Beyonce, a song from Beyonce, I'm like, oh, it's going to be like that. Like, that set the tone. But, you know, the fact that all these great women's players and the great women's basketball coach, you know, Auriemma, I was like, wow, okay. And I'm sure this is a very deliberate choice by Vanessa in selecting the speakers, but it really was a tribute to women's basketball. And I think it was really cool that the women got to speak at this very high profile, very serious event. You know, of all the people that could have spoke, you know, two of the first out of the gate were women's basketball players.
Yeah. So let's segue on to another guy that came into the league as a teenager with the Milwaukee Bucks. He turns 30 as of this recording. It's his 30th birthday, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and I've had the privilege, Jay, of being with the Bucks now as a TV analyst for 10 years. I've watched him. He just turned 20 at the time I came on board. And just your impressions of him and kind of where he was and what'd you think he would wind up compared to where he is now?
Yeah, that skinny kid. I mean, we didn't see it coming. I was always fascinated by him, just, you know, those arms. There was a picture I put on social media one time, and like there was a skirmish breaking out on the court, and Giannis was on the bench, or he was by the bench. He was trying to keep his teammates from running on the court.
You know, yeah, like everybody. Suspension.
And he had his arm, and he had like six guys wrapped in his arms because his arms were so long, right?
Yeah. Yep.
You know, there's another clip I shared. I remember he got a rebound, and then he palmed the ball, and he swung it back. And then he swung it forth, almost like a metronome, right? And he's swinging his arm back and forth. And I kept rewatching. I'm like, this is nothing, but it's something. Like, this is just like, you know, the normal physique just can't do what he just did that easily, to just swing the ball back and forth before he starts walking up the court. So these physical gifts that he had, and then just the combination and the maturation in his game, where he plays such an unselfish game, where... And for a guy that only started playing, like, it's funny, Kobe was basically in the NBA at the same age that Giannis first picked up a basketball, right? Or around that stretch, right? He hadn't been playing that long by the time he got to the NBA. So to learn on the fly in a league in which there's not that much instruction time, that might be the most impressive thing. Like, he hasn't had a lot of instruction time, just the NBA schedule doesn't allow for it, and to still make that much progress in his game. So I think we can make some allowances for, there's still some parts that are somewhat unrefined, maybe you could say, but think about why he didn't come up in, you know, the AAU assembly line like so many other players did.
And we've got a clip of Giannis talking about just you know, his developmental curve and his mindset as he tries to continue to improve himself. Let's roll that clip.
I spend a lot of time working with some of, I don't want to put them out there, but some trainers during the off season, and I think I'm in an age that I've realized that in order for me to be effective and still be able to, you know, allow my team, help my team win games, I have to kind of switch my game a little bit. I feel like, you know, I know I'm effective in the paint when I get down there and I make plays for myself or for my teammates, but like, you know, you take a lot of beating. And now, like, my body today, I'm living, we play in the back-to-back and I feel great. I feel like I haven't been touched, which is incredible. I love this feeling. If I can still, you know, affect the game and help my team win games, I'm heading towards this direction. But one thing you know, had I put everything down. I saw how many mid-range shots I took and how many I made. I think I made like 39 last year in 73 games, and I made 40 something in like 16 games this year. So it's not only I'm literally changing my game, and which it gives me so much dopamine rush in my head, because I've been wanting to do this for a long time. Now there's going to be games that I'm going to make. Last game I didn't make, sorry for my language, I didn't make it, but this game I made them. Hopefully next game I can make some more, but it takes the beating out of me, and my teammates want me to keep on shooting them, so I'm just going to keep on shooting them.
Yeah, man, he talked about the dopamine rush that he gets just from, you know, just working and getting better, and that's what the greats have, right? I mean, just Magic used to talk about that every year. He'd work on a different aspect, come back a better shooter or whatever it was, but, I mean, Giannis is cut from that same cloth.
Well, what I see, and I'm not a guy that worships at the temple of efficiency. I think efficiency can sometimes be overrated. It's not the be-all, end-all, but I do see more efficiency in his game, right, including that 60% field goal percentage now. That's a mark of efficiency. And what he talked about in that clip, just, I think, being able to conserve energy, right, so he can feel fresher from game to game and understand it. And Eddie Johnson said it once. Did you ever play with Eddie, Marcus?
Never with Eddie.
So in a contemporary of yours, so, right?
Yeah, very much so, yes.
But he talked about, I want to say it was 1999. This is locker room to form. He's saying, you know, a veteran can figure out how to get there in 4 steps, where a rookie would take 6 or 7 steps, you know, just literally counting the number of steps it takes to get the path to get somewhere. And so I think Giannis is at that stage where he's literally taking fewer steps to get the places where he wants to go, because he's got the court, the geometry of the court figured out. And he's become more efficient.
How do you think his partnership with Dame has evolved since they first got together last season?
You know, again, just having more time, right? So you got this key new player. And I feel like it's Dame is the one that's had to adjust, right? You're coming to Giannis's team, and Dame for the first time was a secondary guy. And after having, you know, the keys in his hand the whole time when he was in Portland. So I think that's a difficult adjustment for Dame. And I give Dame the credit. You know, to me, all the credit for making it work goes to Dame, not taking anything away from Giannis. But I think it was up to Dame to make that adjustment. You know, it's similar. I don't think it's going to be this dramatic because there's not that level of talent around. But when you look at how Devin Booker went from, you know, being the guy in Phoenix, and in the role he played on the Olympic team, where he was just content to play defense and then make the occasional shots rather than get up a high volume of shots. And I think to a lesser extent, Dame has to do. Dame's still going to get his shots, but it's not going to be the volume that he had. There's a license that comes with that. Steve Curry used to talk about, there was a famous game in the playoffs, Heat versus the Bulls, and Michael Jordan had gone out and played like 48 holes of golf, you know, in the heat and humidity, and he comes out on the court and he's just like brick after brick. He's like, you know, 3 for his first 20 shots, right? But he just keeps shooting, and eventually he gets into it, and the Bulls almost pull off the comeback victory. And Steve Kerr was just in awe of how many shots, but also the license and the latitude to be able to shoot your way out of that, right? Like, Steve Kerr knew his role. If you go 0-for-3, that's probably it. You know, Michael could, and Dame doesn't have the license to go 1-for-12, maybe like he would have in Portland, right? And keep shooting. You know, you got to feed Giannis now, and you can't just shoot your way out of it. So that's a huge adjustment. And again, I think he's more comfortable with his role, and I think he's also just more comfortable being in a new city after being one place for his entire career. Comfort is, I think, an underrated aspect of professional sports, not just the NBA.
Facts.
So listen, man, I'm just a voice crying out in the wilderness, but I've been saying this for a long time. I just feel like the MVP, that's the only award. The MVP should be given out after the NBA finals are over based on the entire NBA season. And I've been saying this for years, J.A., but Giannis's example of winning it twice and then having – subpar playoff results the next couple of years. So the writers here.
Punished him, yeah.
Well, they said.
But Jokic got punished too.
Well, yeah, we're not going to get. I don't care what he does during the regular season. He's not winning the MVP award until he does something in the playoffs. And so it's a conundrum. It just makes no sense to me. My point is, so Jokic is averaging what, a triple double this year, Chris? I just realized that. I looked it up last night.
Easy,
10
easy
assists
triple
a game.
Double.
I think Giannis could, if you know, put his mind to it, he could do that. Russell Westbrook averaged a triple double. Ja, he won the MVP. He averaged a triple double.
Did he do it three
year.
Times?
But if he averaged a triple double next year, he finished fifth. He averaged a triple double the next year, he finished 10th.
Yeah.
He took a year off, he averaged a triple double the fourth year, and finished 11th. Yeah. It's almost like these guys become a prisoner, man, of their own greatness. You know what I mean? Like the numbers don't register like they should. I don't think there's an appreciation.
Or the story moves on. You know, like I look, Stephen Curry, you know, his unanimous MVP season 2016, obviously that's his all time, you know, that's his masterpiece. But in 2017-18, the second year with Durant, so after he had adjusted to having, you know, a key figure, making that adjustment, got more comfortable, his numbers were better than his first MVP season in 2015. His second best season was really that 17-18 season, the second year with Durant. But he finished, I think, fifth in MVP. But he was better than when you gave him the MVP,
right?
But,
right.
like, he wasn't really in the conversation at that point because we'd moved on, right? And maybe because we'd say, well, everyone proclaimed him the best, and then LeBron outshone him outshined him in the finals that year, right? And so everyone kind of reassessed and said, oh, my God, how could we ever think that Steph was better than LeBron, right? We just saw it head-to-head. But you know what? But he was even better than the version of Steph that you gave the MVP to a couple years later, but you'd moved on. And I think we moved on from Giannis, and I feel like people – they regret the fact that they moved on from Jokic. So it's going to be really hard to pry. It's almost his until further notice.
Right.
Just because people were like, well, we punish you because you hadn't done anything in the playoffs. Then you showed you could win a championship. And meanwhile, like there really hasn't been any drop off. Right. But Giannis, you're right. He's doing stuff. He's certainly more efficient than he was. And then plus a career high points, right? He's got his career high scoring average, career high field goal percentage. So, he should be a stronger candidate
than he was
when he won it. But now, I disagree with you, Marcus, on just giving one MVP after the finals. I think there should be a regular season. I think we should reward someone who takes the regular season seriously and goes out and for the totality of those 82 games is the best player. And then we do have the reward, you know, the Bill Russell finals MVP for someone who gets it done in the finals. I think both can coexist.
Well, I think of Andre Iguodala. I think of Cornbread Maxwell, some finals MVPs. You know, that really weren't I digress. But my final question is there what's the word? Collusion? With the voters, with the writers, you're a voter for the MVP. You guys talk and
on a Zoom call.
Let me preface it by saying this, because when I was with the Seattle Sonics, and it was this one year Michael Jordan doing Michael Jordan
Carmelo
type stuff, Kevin Calabro, my highly estimable broadcast partner, usually gave me the MVP award to vote on. He would take certain other awards, Rookie of the Year. But this one year, he took the MVP. I was like, KC, what's up, man? Why did you give me? Why don't I vote on the MVP? He's like, because we are kind of in a mindset, talking about the voters, of getting somebody else the award. Michael had won it twice in a row, and Karl Malone had an MVP caliber type season, no question. And that was the year I think Michael doubled back and stole it from Karl and hit the big shot against Utah that
97.
Same season or whatever. But so that's why I mean. But do you get how much conversation these days goes on with the voters? I don't mean getting together and having a conference call.
Yeah, it's not collusion. I would say it's groupthink, though.
Mm.
Okay, I do think that. People see what other people are saying, and I'll say I look at other people's. So when I had an MVP vote, you know, I would see how other people did because you don't want to be the complete outlier. You want to take other things into consideration. But then at the end, I have to sit down. So the last MVP I had was actually the year Westbrook won it and I voted for him. And I know Harden had a good case. That was a really contentious year. I wound up voting for Westbrook. But
why? Why? Because of the
it was a triple. It wasn't just the triple doubles. It was the fact, and it. So remember, that's the first year KD's gone. Everyone thinks that the Thunder are just going to fall off, and he said no, that ain't happening. If you looked at his consistency, so from November on, and again, Marcus, I looked at the totality of the season. I think it's an award for the entirety of the regular season. And he established that the Thunder were going to be here and that they weren't going to fall off the map completely. And so if you looked his – and from November, he had strong stats. December, you know, and then Harden's stats, like, came on. I think Harden had a big December and then maybe had a big April or something like that. But I like the fact that he established something. He was getting triple-doubles right out the gate, and he willed that team into the playoffs. And then he had a big national TV game where he scored 50 against the Nuggets. I think he makes like a half-court shot to win it or send it in overtime or something. And it was kind of like the Heisman moment. You know, I once upon a time I had a Heisman vote too. You know, and I believe in those moments, but I believe in the totality of the season. And so that year, so that was my thing. My definition of the most valuable player is the person who does the most to put his team in position to contend for a championship, right? Obviously, you can't win the championship in the regular season, but I think setting your team up, that's why it's rarely gone to somebody, and I normally would be reluctant to vote for somebody who's a lower seed, right? To me, you got to be like top two or three seed normally. So the year Russell won it, it was the lowest seeding for an MVP since Moses in 82 or 81.
Right. 81 Houston, I believe, right?
Yeah. So it was a historic level of underachievement for the team. But again, Moses meant that much to that Rockets team, and Westbrook meant that much to that Thunder team, that just giving them a shot, it didn't make them, you know, favorites.
Sure.
But to me, just to give them a chance to play for the championship, I thought he had to do so much lifting that they made him the most valuable. To me, value comes in winning and contributions to winning, and in particular, winning championships. And so the best you can do in the regular season is to put your team in position to win a championship.
Well, we hope that criteria holds serve here with Giannis. Go ahead, Chris.
Last thing on that, J.A., just to backtrack. Did you have a vote when Steve Nash won in 04, 05, and then he won again in 06?
I did not have a vote those years.
But thinking back...
I would have voted for him, actually.
But so you felt like Steve Nash was the most valuable player in the NBA at 04.
So in particular, the second one, actually, even though the numbers weren't that great.
Sure.
But remember, they basically lose Amari Stoudemire for the year, right, due to injury. And they kept right on rolling. And so
That's a great point.
That to me... you know, and he was the engine. And if you go back, I think, and look at the plus minus with him, remember when he would come out and he couldn't play a lot of minutes, right? He had his back. And when he came out, it was just so dicey like that. He was the engine for that whole thing, for that team to revolutionize. And it's almost like if he wasn't the best player in the league that year, and you can certainly make arguments otherwise, but like what that team did to the sport and what he did. Like, do we have Steph Curry without Steve Nash? And Curry is someone who points to Nash as a big, you know, influence on him, right? And then, you know, Steve Kerr coming over from Phoenix and kind of bringing some of those principles that really allowed Curry to flourish, right? So if we look at the role, like, it's almost like we gave him an honorary Oscar. Like, he deserves something for what he did for the league. Maybe back-to-back MVPs is a bit much. I could see that argument. But again, what the team did was get in position to win. Now, obviously, they faltered in the playoffs, and, you know, we can get into that. But I had no problem with what he did both of those years. And you know, it coincided with the virtuoso performances from Kobe, right? But Kobe's team was number eight seeds those years, you know, and wound up losing in the first round to the Suns both of those years. Mm. So I didn't have a problem with it. I know plenty of people who did. A lot of people whose basketball opinions I respect highly disagreed with me on that. But to me, when I look back on those MVPs for now, maybe they haven't aged that well, but at the time, I would have gone the same way. I saw the reasoning. And like I said, in particular for the second one, if you look back on the stats, I think he averaged like 16 points, and you know, but also you know, the shooting efficiency, which we've come to appreciate more now, I say, than we did then. Go look at the shooting numbers.
Oh, yeah.
And but mostly the team was winning like 60 games, right?
Facts, facts.
So final question before we let you go. Who's coming out of the East? Who's coming out of the West? What do you see in terms of June clashes, NBA championship at stake? Who do you like?
I still think it's Boston, and I'm going to say OKC. Ooh. Out of the West, just
they take that step up. They take
yeah, because they're young. That goes against everything I know and everything that I've studied. But man, that SGA,
yeah,
is like a, and like you he like never it? Wows you, right?
Yeah,
fellas, like he never say like, ooh, wow, ooh. He doesn't make my jaw drop like that Kobe shot did, right?
Right,
but
right.
He just gets it done. Like, how do you stop that guy?
Herky jerky. You look up herky jerky in the dictionary. You see his, yeah. You see him, his movement. So yeah,
I don't know how you stop him. But so I'm gonna go with the youngins in part because they play defense, right? They have that old school. You gotta appreciate that, Marcus, right?
Yeah.
Is your social media handle still old school, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is. Yes.
That's old school in that they defend like dogs.
And so, Hardenstein. Hardenstein is a key, too. Hardenstein, I love it. He's a big, big plus for them in terms of backup, man.
But I'm glad the Bucks are back in the mix, though. It's happy to see because it was Ooga time for a minute there, right? The red flags.
2-8. But, oh, my goodness.
And then we get Chris Middleton back in the mix and things.
We'll get Chris Middleton back. And so I think we're headed in the right direction, man. We're going to let you go, man. I don't want to dominate all your day. It's been great, man, talking to you. You're doing some great things. Out there as a professor at Northwestern University. Congratulations again on the Kurt Gowdy Award, the Hall of Fame. Well deserved,
yes,
man.
Yes, sir.
I just appreciate you so much for taking a little bit of time out of your day, well, a lot of time out of your day to come by and join us at Here District. Thank you, J.A. Adande.
Thank you, Johnson's Elder and C. I appreciate it. And our Elder and Junior, I should say. And thanks for having me on. I really appreciate you thinking about
it. Yeah, appreciate you, man. All right, J.A. Adande. We'll be back with more from the Here District.
It started with a prediction.
Go out there and play basketball and win.
And how many games?
6.
It became the culture.
Chance of Bucks in 6.
Being a Bucks fan means you live and breathe Bucks in 6. Brandon Jennings created the prophecy. Tune into Behind the Bucks, the story of Brandon Jennings on the Bucks Plus audio network. Behind the Bucks is presented by Gallagher, your trusted insurance broker and HR and benefits consultant. Available now on Bucks.com/plus, the Bucks app, and streaming wherever you get your podcasts.
That's for the culture.
You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production.
All right, welcome back to Here District. I'm the captain of this vessel, First Mate Chris Johnson, and we want to thank J.A. Adande again for some outstanding insights into all things basketball, and what a great interview. But right now, Chris, it's time for the mailbag.
Mail call!
Yes, sir. This Marcus's mailbag this week. We got some great questions lined up for you. And remember, you can submit your questions on Twitter. Check us out on YouTube. Watch our full episodes on YouTube and go ahead and send in questions on either platform and we'll get them answered for you on the next show. So first up, from the mailbag, I'm digging Santa's mailbag. Where's Santa's mailbag? Excuse me, Marcus's mailbag from B Harms, who's a longtime listener. B Harms, Brian Harmon is in the building. His tweet, Middleton is back. One of my favorite developments this season is how great Prince has fitted on this team. Talking about TP. Do you see his role changing with Middleton returning, or who do you think might have their role changed the most, MJ?
Brian Harmon, we thank you for that question, first of all. And I think it just helps the Bucks in terms of their depth just get even more potent in terms of what they can bring in off the bench with Torian Prince. That's why you brought him here in the first place. And to your point, he has filled in admirably as a starter. He's had some great moments. Haven't looked at the current stats, but I know the last game I did a couple of games ago, he was leading the league in 3-point field goal percentage, about 53-54%. So he's done everything and more that you could ask for. Reliable defensive player, doing a better job taking the ball to the hole. But man, Chris Middleton, we need him. And as good as Torian Prince is, and I'm not looking at stats in front of me, but is he averaging 10 points a game? You know what I mean? I mean, Chris, you would know that better than me. Chris Middleton is a guy that you can plug in and is going to get you on a just a modest kind of average season, 15 points a game, you know. And so that's my point with this situation. Whose role is going to change? It's going to be some diminished minutes somewhere with Chris coming back. Torian Prince's minutes will be diminished. Maybe
will Bobby's minutes be diminished?
You know, I don't think so. I think Bobby, in terms of a backup 4-5, would fit right in there. I think Bobby's best basketball is still ahead of him. He's got an opportunity to come in and really do some things this year. And one of our producers, Dylan, showing me the big screen with Torian Prince, 9 points a game, right? 9 points a game this season. So, and that's great for him. But you need Chris Middleton as that third, and here's the key word, Chris, reliable. That third reliable scorer that you can pencil in for 17, 16, 19, depending on the kind of year he's having. Your thoughts, Chris?
Well, he impacts the game, especially on the offensive end, just from a spacing perspective, because now you got to pay attention to him. You got to care about him a little bit more than you did about TP, because this guy's a certified bucket getter. So I definitely see Middleton's coming back. Some roles will I won't say change, but you know, some guys will get some lesser tick. It's going to get a little shorter. I don't know if it's AJ Green. I don't know if it's potentially a DeLon Wright. I don't know, but I know that something has got to change up as far as the rotation.
Andre Jackson Jr., you don't know who it's going to be. And here's the thing. A guy like a Torian Prince, longtime veteran, been with a lot of teams, he understands who he is. You know what I'm saying? As a basketball player. He's not tripping. I'm back to doing what I'm comfortable doing, coming in, infusing some energy, giving you some wing defense, guarding Jason Tatum for a few possessions, Jaylen Brown for a few possessions. And then here, Chris, take it back. I've had enough. I've had enough. It's back on you, Chris Middleton. And so you know, that puts him more into a Torian Prince comfort zone than having him be a starter and you got to play 30 minutes, 30 to 35 quality minutes every single game and give us 14 or 15. Hey, that's above my pay grade. That's not what I'm here for. You know, I'm here to plug and play, you know, fit me in where I'm needed, you know, fit in where I can get in. And so that'll be a good thing. And it'll be interesting to see just how Doc, and again, the first game back is tonight against the Celtics, so we would have released this show after that. But will Chris Middleton start tonight? Will he be weaned back in slowly, coming off the bench? So that's what the thing that's going to be fascinating for me to watch over the next couple of games of Chris's return. So, all right, moving on. Let's go. Next question.
Thanks, B. Harms. The next question we have from MJ's mailbag, and remember, you can submit your questions to us on Twitter and then watch the full interview or get the full answer to your question in the full interview that we post on Bucks YouTube, the Bucks official YouTube channel. The next question is from @Sage_Alex. Their question is, the Bucks season has had good and bad stretches so far. As former players, how do you keep a good stretch going, and how would you get out of a slump?
MJ? Well, the main thing is to have that belief in yourself, and that starts with the coaching staff, and that starts with
how to get out of a slump. You're saying the belief to
this is the bad stretch. I mean, the good stretch, I mean, you know, you just keep doing the good habits that you created to get into that good. You stay locked in. The bad stretch is the key. The Bucks are 2-8. You know, you got to change. Now I'm reading, Chris, on Wayne Romar, Lorenzo Romar's brother, on Facebook. He always posts things that get me going, but how there's dissension in the Bucks locker room. There's tension with the players. I'm not seeing any of that. And I think Doc Rivers and his staff have done a masterful job of keeping this team collectively together. Giannis, Dame, the leaders of this team, Pat Connaughton, the veterans that have been there, Brooke Lopez that won a championship, Bobby Portis, Chris Middleton, even though he's not playing, you see him active on the sidelines and in the guys' ears, whether it's Giannis or Dame or whether it's younger players, Andre Jackson Jr., whomever. And so the key is just keeping – it's such a cliche, but it's so true – we got to stay together. We got to stick together through these bad times. And then we've got to continue to do the technical aspects that the coaching staff doesn't get enough credit for, because people don't really see the countless hours they put in breaking down film, seeing the minutiae, the details that are not being performed. Whenever you're struggling, a lot of times it's just you're not doing the little things. You're not boxing out. You're not getting back in transition like we saw against the Atlanta Hawks the other night. You're making, you know, just simple mistakes that are causing collective detriment to you as a basketball team. And I think the coaching staff has taken their time. They've done that. And I keep saying this, Chris, I think one of the best things in the world that can happen to this Bucks team is to start off struggling, staggering out of the gate, 2-8, having everybody write them off.
Did you say that? Say that? Or are you just saying that you said that? Because I don't
know. I said that. I said that at some point. And this is after the bad start. And I'm not sure if I said it to
okay.
you. If I,
okay.
you
know, if, I'll give you that.
But this is after the bad start. Everybody's, oh, woe is me, and the Bucks are not this, not that. And you know, on paper, the talent is there that they're going to turn it around eventually. And you look at the schedule, you know, the schedule between now and the end of January, Chris, the Bucks could very easily be 29-17 or 27-15 or something, 10 to 12 games over 500. And if you're sitting there at that point into January, that means you've got great momentum. I think they play they'll also Atlanta. A team that I thought they'd beat at home, but it's the second night of a back-to-back coming off the in-season tournament, the NBA Cup game against Detroit. But they've got Cleveland coming up, they've got Boston coming up, and maybe one other team with a winning record in all this time. So it's a chance to fatten up on some teams that you should beat, and that's going to help your collective psyche. Getting Chris Middleton back is going to help your on-the-court product. And so, you know, I really believe that the coaching staff gets the credit to answer this question in terms of just breaking down what was going wrong, making the correction in with film session, with on-court walkthroughs and all the things I've watched them do. And then the guys have got to, you know, get out there and give me more. Give me more energy. Give me more focus. Give me more of all that good stuff that leads to winning. So, yeah.
Yeah, I honestly think on a professional level, MJ, especially in the NBA, that in order to get out of a prolonged slump, the communication within the team has to, A, increase. It has to be more transparency, and it has to be more accountability. So you got to be able to talk about the stuff that's going wrong. You got to be able, Dame has got to be able to get in Giannis's face and say, hey, X, Y, and Z. Giannis has got to be able to say something to Dame. And Gary Trent's got to be able to do, you know, and it goes down the line as far as the communication standpoint. And that's where I think the Milwaukee Bucks have done or made the most improvement, is that probably the type of communications that they're having now. So now it's not like some elephant in the room and we're kind of going to talk over it. You know, I listen to the press conferences. Now things are, you know, in the beginning, there were sort of these, Giannis would allude to a lot of things.
Yeah,
he wouldn't mention names. Now he's talking about the folks, people. He's mentioning names. He's talking about, you know, hey, one shot. We didn't move the ball. We didn't do this. So as they continue to go through the ups and downs, maintain that level of accountability and communication, I think that the slumps will come far and few between. That'll do it for Marcus's Mailbag. Once again, please submit your questions to us on Twitter and then watch the full episode of the interview of the podcast, on the Bucks official YouTube channel.
So before I let you go, Chris, I gotta get work this in here. So we talked about Wally Pipp on our last show. Wally Pipp was the guy playing first base that took a game off.
You said he was drunk. You said he was hungover.
Lou Gehrig took his spot, and Lou Gehrig wound up playing 2,100 straight games, blah, blah, blah. So I did my Wally Pipp research. I was just curious about Wally Pipp. First of all, you know, he played during the dead ball era. Wally Pipp led the league, the majors, in home runs in 1916. Guess how many he hit during the dead ball era to lead the league?
12.
Exactly. That's great. The next year he led the league again. He hit 9. So that's crazy within itself.
Dead ball.
He and Babe Ruth actually got into an argument, and they were about to fight each other because he bobbled a ball at first base. Babe got into him in the dugout. They're like, we're going to finish this after the game. And so Wally Pipp went looking for Babe Ruth after the game, and Babe kind of, you know, chilled out and like, no, we don't need to do all that. And the team kind of coalesced at that moment. But Wally Pipp, so you hear different versions of why he didn't play in that game.
Yeah.
One was that he had a headache. and that he had been beamed, ball hit in the head by a pitcher like a couple of games before that. But that was disputed because the beaning, you know, actually took place, you know, in July, and that was a month after he asked out of the game.
So what happened?
Well, Lou Gehrig's family, they claim that Wally Pipp was at the racetrack playing the ponies. Lou Gehrig's family, you know, that's a rumor out there that's where Wally Pipp was that day. So he wanted to go to the racetrack.
This is back during kind of the Black Sox. No, this is way. So gambling was kind of like in baseball was there's a heightened sense of like, you know,
sensitivity to it.
Yeah, that's
a good question. But the plausible, I guess, explanation is that, you know, that he wasn't feeling good that day. He had came in with a headache. Asked Miller Huggins, the manager, then they kind of paint over it by saying that you know he knew that Lou Gehrig was the future at first base, and he wanted to make. So I, you know, that story I'm not sure about.
Yeah,
I kind of roll with the betting on the pony story. While they Pip out there, there, where would that be? Sarasota or wherever that would be in New York.
Yeah, you know, come on.
But anyway, fascinating. Just research on Wally Pipp. I wanted to put a button on that, and I promise I never mention that again, man. But thanks, man. Thank you so much. Great, outstanding show. The Fantastic Voyage, here District, Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, Jay Adani. Thank him again for coming by and spending some quality time with us, man. And man, we will see you next week on Here District. We're out of here.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production. Thank you.